Hello, everybody. Welcome back to North Idaho Now. This is episode 60. Whoa, Madison, 60?
Wow.
That's pretty good. That's really good.
I know.
It just hit me. Chance Watson and Madison Hardy coming at you with the news today. And this episode is brought to you by Hecla Mining Company. Hecla Mining Company is a leading low-cost silver producer with operating silver mines in Alaska, Idaho, and Nevada. They're the largest primary silver producer in the U.S., responsible for one-third of the silver produced in our nation. Their philosophy is to operate mines safely by promoting a deeply rooted value-based culture, leveraging mining skills developed over the company's long history, and by innovating new practices. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit Hecla Mining. .com. So Madison, I have to ask you first off, you went to the concert.
The Nelly concert?
Mm-hmm.
I did.
How was it?
You know, actually, I went there for work. I was covering the concert, and just because of some of the stuff that had gone on in the past about people being upset of his attendance,
For one reason or another.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was mainly there just to see what would happen.
Okay.
Nothing really happened. No one was upset. Actually, there was hundreds of people that were very excited to
be there. Oh,
I'm sure. And that was what my story really focused on. But then really what made me annoyed is that the man took 30 minutes to take the stage. And for anyone that doesn't know, we take photos with our stories. And it was starting to get dark to the point of where it was getting very dark. And that makes it a very difficult job to get photos of an event. And, of course, it was hard to get any photos of the crowd because after 30 minutes, they were a little less excited.
Fresh in my memory, was it held, like, where they do the rodeo?
Yeah, and,
like,
the Finley Arena.
Gotcha. So everybody, like, went out onto the arena grounds?
Yep.
Okay, gotcha.
I know. I got to go in the little pit area VIP section, which is just, like, a little square right in that in the center.
So right.
That was pretty cool. You know, definitely a childhood memory. Like, wow, I'm watching Nelly in concert. Of course, I could only stay for 10 minutes because I had to turn the story that night.
Right.
But it was great.
I was going to say, there's not really a close place to go sit down, like, not like a local coffee shop at 10 o'clock at night for...
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
well, it was also, you know, so late that I was starving. And
well, the fair food is there, Madison.
Yeah.
You're not a fan of fair food?
I love fair food. I went to the fair last weekend and I had my fill of fair food. And I'm pretty sure I'm going back again this weekend. So I didn't really want to overload myself.
It's so nice to talk to a co-host that appreciates the fair.
I love the fair. I was so excited. I hadn't gone to a fair in 6 years. I am a huge roller coaster person. I love the silly games. I love the food, the smell.
Our fellow co-host does not appreciate the fair.
That's unfortunate.
I know. It's but you know what, Madison? People are allowed to be wrong.
They're allowed to have
this is America, and people are allowed to be wrong. and Josh is well within his right to be incorrect in this particular case. Well, I'm glad that the concert went well.
Yeah. Are you planning to go to the fair anytime soon? I know Bonner County recently had their fair as well, so I didn't know if you were going to pick and choose.
So I know some of the organizers at the event, and I've always traditionally gone to either I go to the rodeo or I do appreciate the dancing that occurs after the rodeo. That's always been like a It didn't even, like, it just happened. Like, I always would used to go to the rodeo when I was younger, and then we went to the dancing afterwards. So, and in later years, it almost segued into I go for the dancing and the rodeo is kind of secondary. But in either case, I would probably, if nothing else pops up, I probably might make it out there.
Nice.
I already did a walkthrough on Saturday when the big rainstorm came through.
Really?
Yeah, like when it was like sideways raining and everybody like hunkered down. It was great. But I walked through and I really appreciated – I didn't get to talk about this because Josh immediately said, oh, I hate the fair. But I did appreciate that it seemed like there was a lot of new booths.
Yeah.
Like there was some new stuff that – because other than the last 2 years, I've never missed a Coonie County Fair. So it was kind of cool to see some new stuff and freshen it up a little bit.
Yeah, it was nice. I know that a lot of people have been excited about it being 10 days now. And when I was talking to the fair manager several months ago, part of the reason that I wanted to do that was so that it wasn't so crowded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to pack everyone that wants to come into it in 3 days, I think was what it previously was, is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, there were lines still, you know, to get food or to go on the rides.
Of course.
I think it was probably dramatically better than what it could have been if there was 3 days.
I agree. And in fact, I always kind of thought back in the day that it was weird that, like, I remember one year they started it like midweek and then went into the weekend. I do like the fact that it is 10 days. Mm-hmm. Probably a little strain on the staff there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it spreading it out well, okay, maybe I take that back. Maybe it does help with the staff. And the like, yeah, you're there for more days, but it's less heavy lines. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like families and stuff can go from Monday through Thursday, Friday, and then, you know, everybody else can go there on the weekends and have a good time.
Yeah, especially with school about to start back up. It's kind of like that last hurrah for a lot of kiddos. So I think having parents have the ability to kind of make it a more memorable experience with less lines, less waiting.
We have some schools starting up literally next week.
Mm-hmm.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And higher education institutions started this week.
So. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're going to talk about one of our local higher education.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. All right, let's move into Coeur d'Alene Post Falls headlines. But first, initial success or total failure. Mad Bomber Brewing Company, located at 9265 North Government Way in Hayden, Idaho, is a veteran-owned and operated business that has been serving North Idaho since 2013. Swing by the brewery to try the freshly tapped Tripwire Red, a beer with perfect combination of full flavor and light body. Be sure to check out their special events throughout the week, including trivia on Mondays, all-day happy hour on Tuesdays, open mic night on Wednesdays, discounted growler fills on Thursdays, and live music on Fridays and Saturdays. Mad Bomber Brewing also offers a wide selection of ciders from North Idaho Cider for those who may not want beer. Located near Triple Play, come by and mention the podcast when you order to receive $1 off your first beer. Mad Bomber Brewing, recklessly brewed in Hayden, Idaho. They're also taking, I was told to throw this in, that they're also taking orders now for their mug club. So if you, if you're a big beer drinker and want to swing by Mad Bomber on a consistent basis, it's a good deal. All right, moving in, Wednesday, August 25th headlines, fire restrictions end Friday. This is by Kay Thornbrew. Hey, some good news. Recent weather conditions have prompted public, state, and tribal land managers to rescind all fire restrictions in the Coeur d'Alene dispatch zone. Restrictions will end Friday at 12:01 a.m. Coeur d'Alene dispatch zone is comprised of all state endowment, federal, tribal, and private forest land and range land in Benoit, Bonner, Boundary, Kootenai, and Shoshone counties. This also includes National Forest System lands in Washington and Montana that are administered by the Idaho Panhandle National Forests. Though several large fires are still burning in the Idaho Panhandle, recent rainfall and cooler temperatures have reportedly lowered fire danger that informed the need for restrictions. The average fire danger rating across the zone has been lowered 2 levels from extreme to high. Campfires will be allowed starting Friday. Still, the Idaho Department of Lands urged people to use caution while hunting or recreating. The region is still experiencing drought conditions. Above normal fire potential is predicted through September. All kinds of plants can act as fuel for wildland fire, including trees, grasses, shrubs, dead leaves, and fallen pine needles. Even with widespread rain, lightning sparked several fires during the recent thunderstorms, an indication that fuels are still receptive to fire. Area closures associated with the Deceitful and Pritchard fires burning north of the Silver Valley remain in effect, as well as IDL closures for access roads off the North Fork Coeur d'Alene River Road. The Deceitful fire was 40% contained as of late Thursday. The blaze has torched more than 12,200 acres so far. The Pritchard fire remains 100% contained. Yeah, it's been taken care of for a while. Residents in these areas should be prepared to evacuate with supplies gathered and vehicles fueled and ready to go. That would just be applying to the Murray and Eagle areas. Murray and Eagle were moved to the set category. Anybody that was in the ready, like Osborne, Silverton, those are completely out of the out of all restrictions in those areas. Pretty much the only people that should still be in some sort of ready status or set status is the cities of residents in the cities of Murray or Eagle.
Wow.
Amazing what a little rain can do. It literally was back to back. It went Monday, you had that 5 mile drive with the winds, and then Tuesday we had rain, and it literally went from, oh, this is as bad as it's ever been, to, okay, we got this under control. So, and that's just the nature of the fires.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've been happy to have some of the cooler weather pattern flow in, some 70s to 80s, maybe a 90s sparingly down here.
I have very much appreciated the new temperatures. And it's very weird, historically speaking, around this time of year to have these types of temperatures. Usually fair weekend. Like, just going back into my childhood, fair weekend is always hot. It is always miserable. Like, I usually use it as a time to, you know, dress up a little bit, and it's always hot. So the fact that it's actually kind of cool is kind of nice. I appreciate it.
Agreed. All right. Northern Lakes Fire proposing $2 million overrided levy. This one's by Bill Bewley. Northern Lakes Fire District is asking voters to approve a $2 million permanent override on November 2nd. Quote, I don't ever like having to ask our citizens to pay more, but I am confident when they hear the message that they will understand the need, Pat Riley, Northern Lakes Fire District Chief, said. The funds would go towards 12 firefighters and EMTs and two support staff for a new fire station that we built with capital reserve funds between Hayden and Rathdrum. Riley said Tuesday it would improve response times and allow firefighters to keep up with the increasing number of service calls. He said when the district formed in 2000, it received about 670 calls a year. Today, it receives about 5,500 calls as stations in Hayden and Rathdrum and is trending toward the 6,500 by next year. Quote, we are not able to keep up with the demand for service, he said. The proposal requires a 66% or two-thirds vote to pass. If it fails, Riley said it could mean delays in service and longer response times.
Mm.
The increase would cost taxpayers about $30 per $100,000 of their property assessed value annually. The monthly cost for the proposed levy would be about $10.30 based on a home value of $400,000. Voters rejected five Northern Lakes Fire District override levy proposals since 2012. Riley believes that they will have success this time. He said that districts heard voters' message to do more with less, which it has, but the increasing number of calls due to a rising population is straining resources and staffing. The NLFD has operated with the same number of fire stations, engine companies, and ambulances since forming in 2000. Quote, over that period, the NLFD has had no additional increases in funding above the maximum allowed 3%, a press release said. Yet during the same period, the NLFD has experienced a 700% increase in responses and nearly 300% increase in population served.
It kind of goes into a conversation you and I have had before regarding the expansion of services. Like, we have a booming population here right now. It's only natural that we're going to have an increased demand on services. Ergo, we have to have an increase in services.
Yeah, and I think this is a trend that we're seeing in districts across the county right now. You know, there's been so many levies put forth to the voters over the last year, and it's all the same reason. You know, we've been operating at a low value for a really long time. We understand it's hard to pay a little bit more, but if you want to pay the same amount, you're not going to get the same service, and I think that's really what's going to start changing people's minds.
Right. No, I get it. And look, as somebody who's from the area, I understand levy and, you know, ballot fatigue that can definitely come into play. It's happened in the Silver Valley a couple times. So, yeah, I get it. But at the same time, these are important services that they are providing. All right. Moving on to Thursday, August 26 headlines. The need is imminent, says Bill. This was written by Bill Bewley, not said by Bill Bewley. With a record number of COVID-19 patients on Wednesday, Kootenai Health announced it is converting the hospital's largest classroom in its health resource center into a care unit for up to 22 patients. Jeremy Evans, chief regional operations officer, said patients could be in the new care unit as soon as this weekend, or perhaps not at all if discharges exceed admissions. But that's not expected to be the case. Quote, we hope that it does taper off, but our projections show it's going to continue to climb. So it's best to be ready, he said. Quote, we feel the need is imminent. It's urgent, Evans added. Kootenai Health has 96 coronavirus patients Wednesday, with 37 of those requiring critical care. The previous high of 91 was set on December 23rd. Case count shot up locally and nationally in recent weeks, with health officials saying the more contagious Delta variant is responsible. This week, with a 36-hour period, four COVID-19 patients at Kootenai Health passed away, a press release said. Kootenai Health teams worked around the clock starting last week to ensure that new care space meets standards for patients and staff safety and infection prevention. The intent is to use the space to care for low-equity COVID-19 patients. Karen Cabell, chief physician executive, said a concern now is there could soon be even more COVID-19 patients because there are many other, quote, potential spread events happening in the community. She mentioned the North Idaho State Fair, Labor Day weekend, celebrations, and schools will be back in session. The influx of patients at Kootenai Health, along with its shortage of about 500 workers, has strained hospital staff and resources. Cabell said there is still a chance they might need even more beds. Quote, our projections go beyond the 22 beds, she said. It could be as high as 140 or 150 beds total need. We're close to 100 now. This gets us closer to that 125 mark, but there still could be a gap in the future that we'll need to address. So Sounds like a serious situation. I do appreciate the proactiveness of this, though.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it. We had a discussion here at the press room the other day where when there was issues several months ago regarding the ability to be able to treat the high number of people coming into the hospital, they set up a temporary hospital at the fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that space isn't available right now, right. So they had to think outside of the box.
Mm-hmm. Nope, I get it. Well, as long as there's a place to treat these people, then that's a good thing, right?
Yep. All right, let's go on to Friday's headlines. We have NIC Board rescinds mask mandate. This one's by Kay Thornbrew.
Big story.
The North Idaho College Board of Trustees voted in a special meeting Thursday afternoon to rescind the college's mask mandate. NIC President Rick McLennan announced the mandate last week, requiring students, staff, and visitors to wear double-layer face coverings at all times while inside college buildings when two or more people are present. The measure took effect Monday, the first day of classes for NIC's fall semester. Trustees Greg McKenzie and Michael Barnes voted in favor of rescinding the mask mandate, while trustees Ken Howard and Christy Wood voted against. Chair Banducci broke the tie, voting to rescind the mandate. Banducci said the board had to address the mask mandate quickly so students can come and can make an informed decision about whether they want to attend NIC for the fall semester. The last day to withdraw from courses is Sunday. Quote, "We've got a lot of people waiting to see how this meeting unfolded," Banducci said. "It's critical." Trustee Howard criticized Banducci's decision to not allow public comment at the meeting, as well as the limited opportunity for board members to review the proposed changes to the mask policy. Quote, "What we have done with this process tonight is an attempt to ram through language that nobody else gets an opportunity to review," he said. McLennan said NIC's administration implemented the mandate due to rising COVID-19 cases and reports of capacity concerns at Kootenai Health, where a classroom has just been converted, as we talked about in the story previous. During Thursday's meeting, he said a vote to rescind the mask mandate sends a message to the college community that some trustees do not prioritize the health and well-being of students and staff. Quote, "People may die as a result of this," he said.
So, first off, I want to give kudos to Kay on this. This is a very well-balanced story. Gave both sides of the issue. Kudos to Kay on this one. Second off, before we even get into the issue of that, I do want to talk about how the public comment period, honestly, at this point, what else new is going to be said by the community? Mm-hmm. I'm not arguing against people voicing their opinions. I think that that's totally fair. But Madison, how long have we been writing about like the public comment periods when the Panhandle Health District was, you know, doing what new information, what new arguments are going to be presented? That, and as they mentioned before, this is an important thing. Like, a decision needs to be made so students can decide whether or not they want to go to NIC and figure it out. So I agree with that. I think opening up a comment period this particular time would have probably just what new information would have come out?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good point to make. I do understand, though, him saying that the trustees did not have enough time to review it themselves. Mm. The new amended document was only presented to them either to that day or during the meeting.
Gotcha.
So that was kind of frustrating for them. I also know that it's just a very volatile topic now. And there's really just both sides to the coin on this. When I actually watched the meeting last night, I wanted to know what was going on. And, you know, Michael Barnes actually had some very positive things to say. You know, he expressed that he had COVID. He's still dealing with the long-term repercussions of the disease, but he is also firm in his beliefs that if you want to wear a mask, if you believe that it makes you feel safe, that you believe that you're protecting others, then by all means do it. But he personally does not,
right.
Which I think is, you know, a really good way to put it. It's just a difficult time, I think, at NIC. My main takeaway from it, just because of all the work that I've been following about the institution, is that what I'm mainly concerned about, other than the health and welfare of individuals,
of course,
is that they are currently being investigated for their accreditation because of the disagreements and the issues that have been going on between board members.
Right.
And last night was
just another prime example.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of, you know, name calling, very childish conversations.
Ugh.
And that was what made me sad, because ever since I have moved here, I've really thought, like, my perception of community colleges has changed dramatically just by watching NIC. So And it was for the better before I got to know their trustees.
Right. Well, and honestly, I'm an NIC alum, I always thought that it was a cut above kind of a normal community college. I understand why it's not, you know, treated as a university. I get that. But at the same time, I always thought it was an upper tier kind of thing. There's staff there that's respectable, and it's all around. It's a good build. It's a good place, and it's unfortunate that some name calling can be thrown in there. As far as the issue is concerned, I mean, the idea of having the choice to wear a mask or not, that's, I like to think of like almost, that's like a very quintessential North Idaho belief. Like where Idaho almost at its core is, obviously it leans conservative, but North Idaho has always almost had like this more libertarian side of it as mm-hmm. well. And that falls right into that like belief system. And also there is the belief of vaccines. Where do vaccines fit in all of this? Because there was, you know, the belief that if you got the vaccine, masking was not required. In fact, it was kind of, that was one of the selling points of the vaccine, was if you got the vaccine, you don't have to mask. Now it seems like there's been an about face on that for some reason, but it would be interesting to see what the justification on that. But then again, you know, community college, it's not like a bunch of, it's not always, you know, kids fresh out of high school where they're in the least sensitive category in terms of, you know, having serious COVID symptoms. NIC has people from all walks of life, students of all ages. So, I mean, if you have an unvaccinated person that's in that at-risk category, that's a danger for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. Our veterans deserve the best. This is by Ellie Goldman Hilbert. About 300 people gathered Thursday for the historic topping off ceremony celebrating the Post Falls Veterans Home, scheduled for completion next year. The Veterans Home will be the fourth in Idaho, joining Lewiston, Boise, and Pocatello. Quote, "Our veterans deserve the best possible care," said Mark Shample, chief administrator for the Idaho Division of Veteran Services, "and this state-of-the-art facility is the absolute best. About 2 years ago, the Jacklin family donated the land for the project. Quote, we couldn't be more proud as a family," said Doyle Jacklin. "Congratulations, and we've got her done." Governor Brad Little said, "There are many threats to American safety and freedom today, but the ceremony was something for the people of Idaho to celebrate." Quote, "I am proud to recognize our veterans," Little said. "They have earned and deserved our reverence and support. Post Falls Veterans Home represents a, quote, recommitment to honor those who have made our country what it is," he said. The facility, when complete, will have 85,000 square feet of living space with a residential neighborhood and community center. Four household wings will each contain 16 private resident rooms and bathrooms. The community support center plan includes a chapel, barber beauty shop, bistro, activity center, sports club, therapy room, and a gym. The project is expected to complete on time in the fall of 2022. Wow, it sounds like a good building.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see some designs of it, like what actually...
There were some preliminary designs that were done and put out by the state mm-hmm. that just looked awesome.
Did it look awesome?
It did.
Gotcha. Well, I'm excited to see it.
Perfect.
And it sounds like a good addition to Post Falls.
Yeah, you know, this is the first one north of Lewiston.
Really?
So, Post Falls was decided, you know, the state doesn't hand these out willy-nilly.
That's super cool.
You know,
all
you
right.
have to apply for federal funding.
Yeah.
And this was the one that the U.S. government chose.
That's a big deal. Awesome.
And it's really awesome, especially since I think everyone knows we have a very large retirement community, and a lot of those individuals are veterans. So I'm very excited for this project.
Sure.
All right. Lake Advisory Committee dives into action. This one's mine, Madison Hardy. Members of a new advisory committee have 3 months to identify projects that could improve the health of Lake Coeur d'Alene by 2023. The Coeur d'Alene Lake Advisory Committee met Thursday for the first time. The goal was to establish a base knowledge of local water quality issues and open project solicitation. As part of the Governor Brad Little's Building Idaho's Future initiative, the SLAC is tasked with pinpointing projects eligible for $2 million in state funding. Open solicitation for nutrient-reducing projects in the Coeur d'Alene Basin begins next week with the intent of finalizing funding allocations by the year's end. Idaho Department of Environmental Quality Regional Administrator Dan McCracken said projects ready for quick implementation and with the most significant phosphorus loading reduction would receive priority. Millions of tons of metal contaminants like zinc, cadmium, and lead in the Coeur d'Alene Basin stem from historic mining activities in the Silver Valley. Since the mid-1970s, metal concentrations have declined due to imposed environmental regulations. However, the levels of nutrients like phosphorus have inclined, IDEQ limnologist Craig Cooper said. High levels of nutrients like phosphorus cause eutrophication, which increases algae growth and lowers oxygen in water bodies, Cooper said. If the oxygen levels in Lake Coeur d'Alene decrease, the metals resting on its bed will release, damaging the basin's health. Quote, this is what we're trying to avoid, Cooper said. During the Thursday meeting, Little recognized how the water quality in Lake Coeur d'Alene plays a role in supporting North Idaho. Quote, obviously the water quality of not only the lake, but the tributaries that contribute to it are a part of that for this generation and future generations.
I mean, we've talked about it before. Coeur d'Alene Lake is almost the lifeblood of this area. It's a reason why a lot of people come up here. It's definitely... It serves a lot of communities, and it's, especially if you count its tributaries and the rivers that flow into it and out of it, it's majorly important.
It is majorly important, and it's one of those things that Governor Little pointed this out. You know, people, they come visit Coeur d'Alene, they move to Coeur d'Alene, maybe they're Idaho residents, that the first time they're seeing Coeur d'Alene Lake, and it does take your breath away. I know it did when I moved up here. I was just shocked that this was such a beautiful place that we have here in Idaho. Even the Craig Cooper, the limnologist, said that technically the term that is used to describe Coeur d'Alene Lake in its non-scientific terms means blue and beautiful, and I think that just says a lot.
I agree, absolutely. All right, moving out of Coeur d'Alene Post Falls Press headlines and moving into Shoshone News Press headlines for Friday, August 27th. Headline, Mullen Mayor Steps Down. This is by Josh McDonald. The city of Mullen is under new leadership after Don Kochvar stepped down from his position as mayor Thursday evening during a special meeting of the Mullen City Council. Nothing nefarious forced the beloved mayor out, but actually a rule from the company that handles all of Idaho's government retirement and benefits. Kochvar retired as an educator and principal of Mullen Junior Senior High School in May of this year, and in order for him to begin collecting his retirement from the Public Employment Retirement System of Idaho, or PERSI, he had to retire from being mayor as well. Even though Kochvar has donated his mayoral salary back to the city during a 7-year, 8-month tenure, due to retirement legalese, the city was required to pay a small portion into PERSI each month for him. As such, he was technically paying into his PERSI through his mayoral position. Until the next mayoral election is held this November, Mullen City Council Chairman Sam Davis will take up the mantle for the remaining 4 months of Kochvar's term. Kochvar is excited to move into the new chapter of his life and had no intentions of seeking the position for another term. Quote, my plan was always to step down at the end of my term, Kochvar said. I believe in term limits. People shouldn't sit in an office and do it for years. People need new blood, new minds in the office. I have a store to run, which is a full-time job. I have a 20-year list of, well, they're not necessarily honeydews, they're dawn dues. Over his two terms, Kochvar worked tirelessly to improve his city. This includes several beautification projects, but also some exceptionally important infrastructure updates as well. Kochvar has developed a love for the sea, which may keep him away during the summer months, but he is still going to be a prominent fixture in Mullen. He hopes that whoever takes over in January 2020 will approach things with the same diplomatic and level-headed approach that he used during his tenure. According to Kochvar, interim Mayor Davis is a multi-time councilman and has no intentions of running for the spot himself. Those who have worked and lived within the city of Mullen will never forget the service Kochvar has provided to his community over the years. Interim Mayor Davis could not be reached for comment as of press time. That is why we did not get any quotes from him. He was out in the mountains camping.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. kudos for retiring, Don. I've worked with Mayor Kochvar for many years now, Principal Kochvar, whatever capacity he was in at the time. In Mullen, everybody wears multiple hats. So best of luck in retirement, Don. All right, moving down, center of the page, SMC honors their best. This is also by Josh McDonald. Shoshone Medical Center recently announced that Jeff Hill and Toby Hoyam are the 2021 Employees of the Year. Hill has been with SMC for 11 years and began his career with them as a grounds maintenance worker. He has since worked his way into information services. Hoyam worked as the administrative assistant to the facility's CFO and CEO for 6.5 years. While most everyone understands the strain that medical facilities have been under for the last 18 months, when the pandemic began, it was a call for everyone to step up their game, and Hill and Hoyam did just that. As a vital part of the hospital's IT department, Hill became the go-to in the building when it came to things like making sure video chat platforms were operational, telephone and internet services were working at capacity, and that's just scratching the surface of his responsibilities. Never before had such services been as important to the vitality of a rural medical facility as they suddenly were during the pandemic. With the focus of almost everyone shifting toward making hospitals as safe as possible, communication with SMC's higher-ups wasn't always easy, but Hoyo made sure to be on the ball as a competent intermediary between the anxious public, the building's medical staff, and those making decisions in the building. Her dedication to doing whatever was necessary to keep those lines of communication open made her an easy choice for the award. Both recipients were nominated and voted on by their SMC peers, with Hill and Hoyo finishing in a dead-even tie. For Hill, winning the award is something that he never really cared to do. In fact, the level of humility in which he has accepted his award makes it almost seem like he would rather give it to the next coworker he sees. Quote, "It's all about the people here," he said. "They're all my friends, and I feel like we are family here, and that's what has kept me here. It's just such an honor for them to have picked me." Hoyam has since moved on to another career opportunity, but her nominations include accolades to her about her tireless dedication and loyalty to SMC, as well as her ability to accomplish even the most challenging of tasks. Congratulations to both of them. Sounds like they worked really hard. I've definitely worked with Toby multiple times with stories that I've written regarding SMC, nice things, and even some not so nice things regarding COVID stuff. But she was definitely a good coworker. So congratulations to both of them.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. All right, that takes us out of Shoshone News Press headlines and into the Bonner County Daily Bee out of Sandpoint. For Wednesday, August 25th.
Yep, we have COVID guidelines prompt debate. This one's by Emily Bonsant. Parents, staff, and health officials weighed in on the Lake Pend Oreille School District's recently adopted COVID guidelines for the upcoming school year. Pam Webb, an English teacher at Sandpoint High School, said the schools practice fire drills and shooter drills and recently purchased buses with seat belts. The reason is that everyone cares about safety. As an educator, she said it is important that she feel safe where she works. Webb went on to say that she was concerned that the Bonner County is still in the red status. Quote, "Last year, when we were in red status, we were in masks. We're in red now, and we're not doing masks. This is a choice. I don't feel that safety is a personal choice," said Webb. In response to Webb, Melinda Rossman, principal of the Homeschool Academy, speaking as a private citizen, said she disagreed. Quote, "We're being fed nothing but lies in the media, and it's affecting every aspect of our lives," she said. "On a daily basis, CDC, NIH, FDA change their wording, and it's affecting everything we do. It's creating a divisiveness like never before. We as a community need to come together and seek the truth together and respect each other's opinions." Dr. Scott Dunn, a physician at Family Health Center, spoke on the, quote, "facts as they know them" when it comes to the Delta variant. Quote, "Myself and my colleagues believe that in-person learning is vital for our students," Dunn said. "The capacity for new patients right now is at zero on medical and zero in the ICU," said Dunn. "For somebody new to be admitted, a patient has to be discharged," Dunn said, adding oxygen supplies have been running below due to phenomenal demand. Dr. Carol Waters, also of the Family Health Center, spoke to the severity of the Delta variant. Quote, "It's not only 2 or 3 times more contagious, it also has a shorter incubation, and it's seemingly to infect younger patients than the original virus did, and also infect them more severely," Waters said. Quote, "So we respectfully ask you to consider the facts, consider the science, and reinstitute a mask mandate for the fall."
Interesting. Sounds like this conversation is happening all over the place.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I ever hear about.
It's almost kind of annoyed of it, huh?
Yeah, that fatigue, mm-hmm. The COVID fatigue that everyone was talking about a couple months ago. I am now at COVID anger.
COVID anger, yeah. That's
COVID resentment.
I'm so there. I'm so tired of literally everywhere I go. Everyone wants to talk about it. Yeah. Moving down, WBCSD announces new COVID protocols. This is by Emily Bonsant. When West Bonner County School District opens for school this fall, it will be with health guidance and protocols that are in agreement with the Panhandle Health District. Every Thursday, PHD updates the COVID risk level for each county. Currently, Bonner County is in red status, or Category 3, the highest level of COVID threat. I believe all counties in Panhandle Health District are currently in red. Yeah, this is the subject to change, but if the county stays in this category, WBCSD will return to a hybrid schedule. During a hybrid schedule, students will attend school either on Mondays and Tuesdays or Wednesdays and Thursdays. Schools will do their best to ensure children from the same families attend school on the same day. During red status, students and staff will be required to wear masks or cloth face coverings when social distancing is not possible. Quote, "We have worked very hard to create space in classrooms to allow students to social distance," WBC SD Superintendent Paul Anselmo said, following CDC guidelines, vaccinated individuals willing and able to show proof will not be required to wear a mask, Anselmo said. The hybrid schedule may be used in one or all schools depending on the need, Anselmo said. Fridays would be used for teacher prep, planning and staff development, and academic labs and interventions for students who need additional support. Quote, this year we will focus on social distancing and hope to limit mask wearing in the future, Anselmo said. WBCSD will follow the guidance and directions from the Idaho High School Activities Association and the governing bodies of other extracurricular activities. I think that this is probably smart. I mean, when you're a school, you got to follow what PhD is recommending. I think that that's kind of you can sit there and agree or disagree, but if I'm a superintendent, I'm just going to do what Panhandle Health says. That's pretty much makes sense.
Yeah, I definitely think it's one of those things where, you know, your mom told you not to touch the hot stove because it was going to burn your hand.
Yeah.
So maybe you did it, you burned your hand, and then you learned your lesson. I think I don't want to say anyone should learn their lesson on COVID-19 protocols, but I think we already have. You know, last year our students really struggled. It's hard when you have to be pulled out of school because you're sick.
Sure.
So I think, in my opinion, I always think of education as one of our most valuable resources we can give a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if this will keep them
in school,
receiving this education, that's what matters.
I agree. And I do want to shout out the superintendent here, because while I know some of our listeners might balk at the idea of having to show proof of vaccination, I know that that's also a touchy subject. I do like the fact that if someone is comfortable showing proof of vaccination, like it's not required or anything, but if they're willing to show proof of vaccination, then they don't have to wear a mask. And I think that's, I think that's a very reasonable compromise we don't have to have such hard opinions on all of this kind of stuff. There can be good compromise. And I think that this is a very appropriate compromise.
Agreed.
Cool.
Perfect. So we're down Thursday.
We are down Thursday.
All right. Housing crisis affects employment. This one's by Emily Bonsant. Housing prices are on the rise and the service industry is feeling the crunch. In response, local real estate officials and business owners are hoping to start a conversation on how locals can overcome future housing issues. Quote, an apartment near the Pondere Walmart costs $2,300 a month in rent. Someone making $5,000 a month will be paying almost 50% of their income to rent. This is not affordable housing, Luke Webster, realtor at Evergreen Realty, said. A single-wide trailer costs $250,000. Under the U.S. Department of Housing and Development affordable housing definition, the only people that can afford this are two dual incomes of $50,000 a year, and they don't want to live in a trailer, Webster said. Quote, locals can sell, but where will they live? Rafael Barta of Century 21 Riverstone said, Sandpoint has limited space to build and is geographically stuck between Schweitzer and Lake Pondere. Sandpoint is becoming like Aspen, Vail, Jackson Hole, and other mountain resort towns, Barta said. Such cities as the ones above are beautiful, but the locals are outpriced, which causes the service industry to dwindle and negatively affects local business. Bonner County is no different, Webster said. Quote, as an employer, how do you find housing for employees? How does the service industry still function if there's no housing for servers and retail workers, Webster said. A walk around the city's downtown core shows help wanted signs in every other window. Business owner Dustin Dick of Trinity at City Beach is worried about growth, affordability, lack of workforce and housing. Dick has a condo that he rents out to employees. Other business owners also do the same.
Not surprising. It's just so laughable at this point. Like I don't. We've been reading stories like this for so long. We're sitting here. I don't want to say like we are very much aware of the problem, and I don't. As somebody who likes to think of himself as, you know, at least semi intelligent when it comes to, I'm fairly informed on all types of issues. I don't know what the answer is. I don't, you know, how do you make homes more affordable? basic cost and demand would imply that we have to build more homes, but apparently we've been doing that, and it's still we're still behind on the demand.
Yeah, and so, there's just like another factor at play. I think that really does need to be highlighted more, is that you know, we need more, we're thinking supply and demand, and that's not just a linear thing. You know, the supply of houses is really largely dependent on how fast we can build these things and for how much. And through the COVID-19 pandemic, the price of lumber and steel and other construction items skyrocketed hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, if you try to go buy a wood plank at Home Depot to build little Jimmy a birdhouse, it is five times the amount it used to be. And so that makes it a difficult one. Two, the ability to find workers, as was expressed, is very, very difficult. And construction is in high demand right now. So there's all these different factors that I remember writing a story several months ago that says, you know, builders promise their client, oh yeah, we're going to have this house be done by this time and it's going to cost about this much. Well, through COVID, the timing was pushed back. So they had to continue paying their workers more and the price of their supplies was pushed up. So the house that was supposed to be $450,000 at the end of completion last May was being completed in October and it's twice the asking price.
Unfortunately, I mean, everything you just said is accurate. I don't, it doesn't seem like that. Like we're sitting here, you know, we're talking more about the, we've outlined all the issues. I just don't, and there's so many issues. It's hard to even come up with solutions at the moment. You know,
I mean, I think, and this is not going to be a popular opinion, I think one of the main solutions that I have started thinking in my head is that we have to wait. Almost, which is not really a viable solution.
Things get worse before they get better kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's we need the price to come down.
Sure.
We need workers to come back. We need people to hold on. And we need people to stop coming here and buying
our houses. Or we just have people just stop coming up here. Dadgummit. Got those mad out-of-towners coming up here.
Just close the Idaho border.
I don't know. I don't know who that was. Whoever that was. Get out. Get out of here. I don't even know where that... that person came from. I don't know who that was. All right. Moving down. Federal money, state plan, county approval? Question mark. Yeah, that's a little
county approval?
By Anissa Keith. Wariness of a state-initiated broadband project has led Bonner County commissioners to draft an additional contract yet to be signed by the internet provider. The Idaho Department of Commerce is asking commissioners to approve a $1.53 million broadband infrastructure project with Ziply Fiber to improve middle-mile broadband service in the Spring Creek and Blanchard areas. Middle-mile broadband does not directly involve the end consumer, but provides the infrastructure that allows connectivity to be possible. Such service is expensive to build, but is cost-effective when compared to current service providers. Something very similar is also occurring in the Silver Valley. The project is funded with the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. Though Bonner County commissioners were not involved in developing the state contract with Ziply, Idaho officials requested board approval to build the infrastructure locally. Commissioners were wary to hand over the okay. Quote, "This is not our program," said Commissioner Dan McDonald. "This is a program coming out of the state with CARES Act money, and we're just a vehicle it has to pass through." Bonner County isn't the only county that will be receiving the infrastructure improvements, but it will receive the largest percentage of money from the project. The major caveat to the project is that it may not be legal, according to Deputy Prosecutor Scott Bauer. Quote, "Right now, everybody is in the spend, spend, spend mode. Once that subsides, the regulators will come in to make sure that every penny is being spent correctly," Bauer said. The state government has been shifting the responsibility for spending that money through the local governments. If CARES Act dollars are not acceptable for broadband expansion, the county taxpayers will be on the hook for repaying the federal government, he said. In response, commissioners are drawing up a more restrictive contract than a current agreement between Ziply and the state. Commissioners said that the contract will be completed within the next 2 weeks, that's then sent to Ziply for consideration. If approved, the county taxpayers will be shielded from the responsibility for paying for the infrastructure projects if the CARES money was misused, officials said. Quote, "We feel that the state of Idaho was completely misinterpreting the CARES Act in favor of spend, spend, spend," Bauer said. Ooh, that's I feel the North Idaho roots in this. Like this is just a very classic North Idaho argument of like never trust when federal money comes. Yeah, never trust the man. There's always strings attached when the federal government's coming in. What is it that Ronald Reagan said? The scariest words in the English dictionary are "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
It's funny that you say that because I actually today I got off the phone with a government official and he was saying, "I feel like everyone tends to think that we're the big bad wolf. or that we're just going to cause some problems for them. And I was like,
And you know what? You and I, here in this business, we can so totally relate to that because we, if it's not the government, it's the media's fault, Madison.
Yes. Or the scientists are lying to us. Or the teachers are not teaching the right things. I think everyone just has something. I don't know how all these institutions became so untrusted so rapidly.
Mm-hmm. When I was a victim for the dunk tank in Wallace.
When I was a victim
for the dunk tank in Wallace, they were one of the incentivizers to throw a ball and dunk me into the tank was that I'm fake news.
I think one of my favorite things that happens, I don't want to say frequently, is that someone will ask me, I'll tell them I'm from the media, and someone will ask me if I'm going to spin their story, and then I explain to them that I rely on the facts, and that's all I do. And then they call me after the story comes out, and they're like, you know, you did a really good job. It was very fair and balanced. I'm like, that was my job.
I think people don't, and this is just for everybody. Like, I think people definitely, there is, even as somebody who works in media and journalism, right, in the media, we are not Fox News or CNN or MSNBC. Like,
it's who you listen to.
It's who you listen to and what we're reporting. Like,
and frankly, national news agencies.
Right, Shepard Smith, Wolf Blitzer, all of them. They're not interested in, you know, writing about a charity event from the local firefighters union or something like that. They're there with a specific agenda and to you know, kind of rile people up sometimes. Whereas we're here to just report the news. And that's what we try to do the best of our ability.
I think the best thing that we can do, what is the quote that people believe is the Benjamin Franklin quote? The most important thing about a public is to have an educated public or something like that. And I think that's so accurate. I don't think it's my job to tell you what to think. It's my job to present you the facts and the resources to figure it out for yourself.
Going back to that, again, kudos back to Kay on that one NIC story. That's a perfect example of that. Like, she presented both sides of it. It was succinct, too. I liked that. Very good.
She's a great writer.
She is. Too much. It's going to go to her head now. She's going to think she's the best here.
Not her personality type.
Just kidding, Kay.
All right, we're going on to Friday. Cooler weather aids firefighters. This one's by Anissa Keith. Containment is growing on the Trestle Creek complex. With 15% containment, a team of 445 personnel from the Nevada Type 3 Incident Management Team is working on the fires that have burned over 6,600 acres located 4 miles north of Hope. Wow, that is a lot of acreage. In a video posted by the Type 3 team to update residents on the fires, meteorologist Lamont Bain said additional rain may be on the way. Bain forecast a 15% chance of showers tomorrow with moisture moving into the area from the south-southwest. Woo! Crews are attacking the fire directly and indirectly on the southern and western flanks of the fire, which began on July 7th after a lightning storm hit the area. In Montana, Northern Rockies Team 7 has been given authority over two fires burning around Troy, Montana. South Yak Fire, the larger of the two, has burned over 12,000 acres, my lord, and is being fought directly and indirectly along the northern and eastern flanks. At 68% contained, crews are working to expand containment lines with a team of 170 personnel. Cooler temperatures in the area are expected to lessen fire activity for the next couple days. Team 7 is splitting resources between the South Yak and the Burnt Peak Fire, with 121 personnel working on the 4,000-acre fire. 32% of the Burnt Peak Fire is contained. Road closures on all fires remain in place at this time.
Kind of ties back into what we were talking about earlier.
Bring the rain, baby.
Yes, absolutely. All right, jumping even further north, rounding up the show, moving up to the Bonner's Ferry Herald headlines from Thursday, August 26th. Boundary County Museum hosts a new cemetery walk. This is by Rose Shababy. Susan Chemis and Dottie Gray of the Boundary County Museum and Historical Society share a love of cemeteries. Quote, "They tell great stories," Gray said. Both women find joy in learning about the history of the people who have been laid to rest, and when Gray's daughter-in-law mentioned a cemetery walk in another town, they knew it was an activity they wanted to offer Boundary County. The Parker Family Cemetery tour this Saturday, August 28th, will be the seventh since they first started with the Grand View Cemetery. Chemis pours herself into the research for the tours, learning as much as she can about the cemetery's permanent residents. Prepping for the Parker tour tour took place over the course of about 2 years. The research filled a thick binder with photos, biographies, and other tidbits of information that will be all part of the Parker Family Cemetery tour. Most of the cemeteries there toured are bigger, but the Parker Family Cemetery is exactly what it sounds like, a private cemetery managed by the family. Everyone buried in it is related to the original Parkers, William, W.C., and Betty Parker. W.C. and Betty moved to Bonner's Ferry from Virginia in 1901. Story goes that they took a train with from Spokane, Washington as their final destination. However, when the train stopped in Bonner's Ferry, they were so struck by the beauty of the area that they got off the train and stayed. W.C. was even quoted as saying that the, quote, railroad still owes him a ticket to Spokane because of it. The Parker Family Cemetery tour is Saturday, August 28th at 1 p.m. Chemist and Gray recommend that anyone interested in attending the tour show up on time as it will start promptly. Bonner County Museum is located at 7229 Main Street, Bonner's Ferry, and can be reached at 208-267-7720. Rose, great story.
She really did a great job.
That was a really good story, Rose. Very good job.
We are two history buffs, though, so maybe we're all
That's biased. Fair. Like, we appreciate... That's so it, though. Like, I appreciate historical writing. Nothing wrong with journalistic writing. I appreciate the, you know, say as much as you can with as few words as possible. I get that. But at the same time, historical writing, there's a part of me that there's something so complete about it. And not only that, but just the subject of this is so cool. I think that's super cool that, they find joy in doing something like this. People might be interested in it. And the fact that these people are being remembered.
Absolutely. And I think it was interesting. They pointed out that this was kind of a different one for them. Usually they do like kind of a big swath of a cemetery with a ton of different people. I've always thought like the idea of a family coliseum is such a cool, interesting idea. And, you know, maybe going back through that, especially in a community like Bonner's Ferry where everyone is so connected.
Yes.
It's awesome.
Yep. I agree. All right. That's it. Madison, that's all we got for today.
Oh my goodness, that flew by.
We did. We had a good episode. Good solid episode with lots of good content.
Number 60 in the books.
I know. We are pretty awesome, Madison.
I try.
Well, once again, we'd like to thank Hecla Mining Company for sponsoring this episode. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit heclamining.com. Thanks again for listening in, everyone. We really appreciate it. Please like, comment, and share all of our stuff on social media. If you're interested in the stories we talked about today or the ones we did not, check us out at www.coeurdalandpress.com, shoshonenewspress.com, bonnercountydailybee.com, or thebonnersferryherald.com. If you listen to us on a podcatcher like Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, Player Pandora. FM, all of them, any of them at all, please subscribe and or follow and or like us so you can get every episode as soon as it comes out. And as always, please, all of our advertisers go in and mention us. It's a win for everyone around. You'll get a discount. They know that the ad's working and, they'll keep buying ads from us, which keeps us, employed.
Yeah. So if you want to keep making Chance happy.
I mean, that's how we all have jobs. I mean, if you want to keep listening, that's honestly, I mean, there's no reason to sugarcoat it here. This isn't a charity.
Oh, on a side note, I do want to say something that really broke my heart this week.
What's that?
I found out that you can get a starting pay job at Panda Express for $19 an hour.
That does hurt my soul.
Doesn't that hurt your soul?
It does really hurt my soul.
Well, now that I've hurt everyone's soul.
All right, everybody. Thanks again, and we will see you on Tuesday.